GSF 90.1 FM. Jyoti Burnaby, British Columbia, which sthit hai.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I'm going to fight the global war on terror. I'm going after bad people, evil people. When I get a chance to stamp out evil in this world, I love that. Sorry. I love hunting down bad guys and ending them.
American mercenaries hired by the United Arab Emirates to kill in Yemen. An investigative report by the BBC reveals new details of an assassination program. But first, as the U.S. launches new airstrikes in Yemen, we take a look at the Houthis and their support for Palestine. Then, on this first day of Black History Month, how racism shapes healthcare in America.
There's nothing inherently or biologically wrong with Black people, but there is something very, very wrong with the systems in this country that cause us harm and lead us to live shortened lives.
We'll speak with Dr. Uche Blackstock about her new book, Legacy, A Black Physician Reckons with Racism in Medicine. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian officials are accusing Israeli forces of carrying out execution-style killings in Gaza after the discovery of a mass grave containing at least 30 decomposing bodies. Some of the victims were blindfolded with their hands tied behind their backs with zip ties. The bodies were found on the grounds of a school in Beit Lahia. Al Jazeera spoke to one man who helped discover the bodies.
Inside the schoolyard, we were shocked to find the dead bodies. Those are Palestinian civilians, blindfolded and handcuffed at the back. The dead bodies were kept inside black plastic bags.
The discovery of the mass grave comes as the death toll in Gaza has topped 27,000. At least another 66,000 people have been injured. The group Euromed Human Rights Monitor is now estimating more than 25,000 Palestinian children have lost one or both parents in Gaza over the last 4 months. In central Gaza, the two largest hospitals in Khan Yunis have run out of food amidst Israel's assault on the city. Dr. Nassim Hassan, the head of the emergency unit at Nasser Hospital, denounced Israel's attack on medical institutions.
We are talking about war and genocide against everyone. What's happening now in Gaza, since the beginning of the war until now, is a war against hospitals, a war against the healthcare system. Yes, hospitals have been destroyed, medical storehouses as well. Many ambulance vehicles were destroyed. Many EMS officers were martyred. There have been direct and indirect targeting of paramedics.
On the diplomatic front, Hamas's political leader Ismail Haniyeh is reportedly in Cairo today as negotiations continue over a possible pause in the fighting and a new hostage deal. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's also headed back to Israel in the coming days. In more news on Gaza, South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, has called on all nations to halt military support to Israel after the International Court of Justice ordered Israel last week to prevent genocide in Gaza. Pandor spoke in Pretoria, South Africa.
This necessarily imposes an obligation on all states to cease funding and facilitating Israel's military actions, which, as the court has indicated, are plausibly genocidal.
In related news, a U.S. federal court has dismissed a lawsuit filed by a group of Palestinian Americans against President Biden and other officials for failing to prevent genocide in Gaza. The court dismissed the suit on jurisdictional grounds, but ruled it's plausible Israel's engaging in genocide. In its ruling, the court wrote The evidence and testimony presented, quote, indicate the ongoing military siege in Gaza is intended to eradicate a whole people and therefore plausibly falls within the international prohibition against genocide, unquote. The lawsuit had been brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Visit democracynow.org to see our coverage of the case. U.S. forces have bombed Yemen again. U.S. Central Command said the attack targeted 10 Houthi drones and a ground control center. The Houthis have vowed to continue targeting ships linked to Israel and the United States until Israel halts its assault on Gaza. Meanwhile, NBC News is reporting President Biden's considering launching a weeks-long retaliatory campaign against Iran-backed militant groups following Sunday's deadly drone strike on a secret U.S. air base in Jordan that killed three U.S. soldiers. On Wednesday, the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guard said Tehran was, quote, not looking for war, unquote. One powerful Iraq-based militia group, Kataib Hezbollah, has announced it will halt operations targeting the United States in the region, saying it wanted to prevent embarrassment to the Iraqi government. The Biden administration accused the group of being involved in the Jordan drone attack. The Chicago City Council narrowly voted Wednesday to pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Democratic Mayor Brandon Johnson cast the tie-breaking vote, which was met with an eruption of cheers from activists who gathered in hundreds at Chicago City Hall to support the measure. Reverend Jesse Jackson was also present to show his support. At least 47 U.S. cities have passed resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Meanwhile, in Minneapolis, another Democratic mayor, Jacob Frey, vetoed a city council resolution calling for a ceasefire that was passed last week. Frey said the measure was too one-sided in favor of Palestinians and that he's open to signing a ceasefire resolution that's more, quote, unquote, unifying. The resolution was passed with a veto-proof majority, so council members could still decide to override the mayor's veto. Protests against the U.S.-funded war in Gaza continue across the United States. Activists have been camped outside the Virginia home of Secretary of State Antony Blinken for a week, loudly chanting slogans through megaphones like Secretary of Genocide and encouraging passing cars to honk. On Capitol Hill, five activists with Code Pink were arrested earlier this week as the group disrupted a House hearing on the U.S.'s decision to suspend funding for UNRWA, the U.N. Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Yesterday, members of the Arab American community in Dearborn, Michigan, gathered to protest against President Biden ahead of his visit today to the key swing state and just weeks ahead of Michigan's February 27th presidential primary.
I voted for Bernie Sanders, which tells you where I was on the spectrum. And to have a person like me to go from that extreme to say that I'm now willing to vote for Trump in order to oust Genocide Joe, it's really a testament to how Biden has lost big time within my community.
Kenyan President William Ruto is vowing to proceed with a plan to send 1,000 Kenyan police officers to Haiti, despite a court ruling that the deployment would be unconstitutional. The UN Security Council approved the mission last year as part of an effort to help combat gang violence, which has grown under Haiti's unelected leader, the U.S.-backed Ariel Henry, who's ruled since the 2021 assassination of Jovenel Moïse. Meanwhile, the UN and aid groups are warning about a surge in sexual assaults and collective rapes in Haiti as gangs fight to expand their power. On Wednesday, protesters in Port-au-Prince burned barricades to protest Prime Minister Ariel Henry's rule.
The people can't take it anymore because Ariel Henry is building gangs to plunder and destroy these people. Well, today we say that the battle for the revolution is possible. The final fight for justice is possible. We must disrupt this Ariel with all his team to give this country another direction.
In Belgium, farmers from across Europe have converged in the capital of Brussels, calling on European Union leaders to end free trade agreements that allow cheaper goods to dominate the market and ease environmental regulations. Hundreds of tractors have taken over Luxembourg Square near the European Parliament. Farmers clash with police, who hose some of the protesters with water. This is an Italian farmer.
First of all, we decided to come here to join with other kind of European young farmers to create a unique voice, not against, but with the cooperation of the European Parliament and the other kind of politics, because we'd like to safeguard our tradition, our farmers' mood, our quality of food, but to safeguard the majority part of this kind of situation, the dignified incomes.
The farmer protests, which started in France but soon spread across the EU, have disrupted traffic and led to confrontations with police in recent weeks and rising tensions ahead of today's EU summit. Some far-right nationalist leaders have seized on the movement to gain traction and foment anti-EU sentiment, including France's Marine Le Pen and the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who met with farmers in Brussels earlier today. A sweeping new government study finds contaminated water at the Camp Lejeune military base in North Carolina led to elevated cancer rates among people who lived and worked at Lejeune decades ago. Previous studies linked the drinking water at the base to blood and organ cancers and Parkinson's disease. Victims of the contamination, which plagued Camp Lejeune from at least 1953 to 1987, have for years been fighting for compensation and recognition from the U.S. government. The new findings are likely to boost their legal claims, which they have until August to file under a new federal law. Over 160,000 claims have been filed so far. On Capitol Hill, senators on the Judiciary Committee grilled the CEOs of Meta, TikTok, X, Snapchat, and Discord Wednesday, arguing social media companies must be held accountable for the sexual exploitation of children that their apps facilitate and the harmful effects of their products on the mental health of young people. This is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham addressing Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
You and the companies before us, I know you don't mean it to be so, but you have blood on your hands. You have a product. You have a product that's killing people. When we had cigarettes killing people, we did some about it, maybe not enough. You're going to talk about guns? We have the ATF. Nothing here. There's not a damn thing anybody can do about it. You can't be sued.
In one of the session's most sensational moments, Mark Zuckerberg stood up and awkwardly apologized to the families who were present at the hearing after being pressured by Republican Senator Josh Hawley.
I'm sorry for everything that you have all gone through. It's terrible. No one should have to go through the things that your families have suffered. And this is why we invest so much and are going to continue doing industry-leading efforts to make sure that no one has to go through the types of things that your families have had to suffer.
Many families held up photos of their children who died or were harmed by social media. Snapchat CEO Evan Spiegel also directly apologized to families after prompting from California Democrat LaFonza Butler. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Tom Cotton hounded TikTok CEO Suzy Chew, who is Singaporean, over citizenship and ties to the Chinese government.
Have you ever been a member of the Chinese Communist Party?
Senator, I'm Singaporean. No.
Have you ever been associated or affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party?
No, Senator. Again, okay. I'm Singaporean.
Senator Cotton and Republican colleagues have called for TikTok to be banned, claiming it's a spy app for the Chinese Communist Party, unquote. Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, the House Wednesday passed a $78 billion bill that would expand the child tax credit while reviving some corporate tax breaks. While hailed as a bipartisan victory by centrist lawmakers, around two dozen Democrats voted against it. Progressive congressmember from Texas, Greg Kassar, was one of them, arguing, quote, in exchange for a partial return of the child tax credit, Republicans got hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate tax cuts. For every dollar going to kids in this bill, $5 goes to corporations. We have the money to pull every child in America out of poverty. We just need to say no to accepting crumbs while corporations get a full steak dinner, Kassar said. A Delaware judge has voided the $56 billion compensation package of Tesla CEO Elon Musk. The judge noted the astronomical 2018 pay package was the largest ever in public corporate history, and that Tesla's board failed to prove the compensation plan was fair. And in more related news, Senator Bernie Sanders and Democratic lawmakers are pushing a union-backed bill that would raise taxes on companies where CEOs make more than 50 times above the salary of an average worker. The measure could raise $150 billion in revenue over a decade. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. The U.S. military carried out new airstrikes in Yemen today, targeting 10 drones and a ground control station that it said, quote, presented an imminent threat to merchant vessels and U.S. Navy ships in the region. The airstrikes are the latest targeting the Houthis. The group, also known as Ansar Allah, has waged a campaign of attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden since November 19th in response to Israel's assault on Gaza. On Tuesday, U.S. Central Command said its forces shot down an anti-ship cruise missile. According to CNN, the missile came within a mile of a U.S. destroyer before it was shot down, marking the closest a Houthi attack has come to a U.S. warship. Meanwhile, the Houthis said they would stage more attacks on U.S. and British warships in the Red Sea in what they called acts of self-defense. This is Houthi military spokesperson Yahya Saria on Wednesday.
The Yemeni armed forces will confront the American-British escalation with escalation and will not hesitate to carry out comprehensive and effective military operations in retaliation to any British-American foolishness against beloved Yemen.
The Houthi campaign targeting shipping has affected a key route for global trade between Asia, the Middle East, and Europe, with several shipping companies suspending transit through the Red Sea. On Thursday, Italy's defense minister warned the shipping disruptions threaten to destabilize Italy's economy. This comes as the European Union's foreign minister, Josep Borrell, said on Wednesday the EU plans to launch a naval mission of its own within 3 weeks to help defend cargo ships in the Red Sea. For more, we're joined by Helen Lackner, the author of several books on Yemen, including Yemen in Crisis, The Road to War, and Yemen, Poverty and Conflict. She's been involved with Yemen for over half a century, lived there for a total of more than 15 years between the 70s and the 2010s. She's joining us from Oxford, England. Helen Lackner, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us who the Houthis are and explain what their demands are, the significance of what's happening in the Red Sea?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I think I'll start with the second half of your question, which relates directly to what has been happening and the various announcements you've just made. And the Houthis have been extremely explicit and repeat on an almost daily basis that their attacks on ships in the Red Sea will stop as soon as the Gaza war ends and humanitarian and other supplies are allowed into Gaza, and therefore the Palestinians will no longer be under the threat and the horrors that you've earlier described and that most of us have seen on our screens for many, many weeks. So the important thing is that although the US and the UK claim that they're only defending free movement in the Red Sea and refuse to accept any connection between this and the war in Gaza, for the Houthis, it's absolutely straightforward and explicit that, number one, they're only targeting ships that have any connection with Israel, whether they're going to Israel, coming from Israel, delivering stuff owned by Israelis or whatever, any connection whatever, and that other ships are not targeted, except, of course, now, since the US and UK strikes have started, they are also targeting US and UK ships. So they're absolutely explicit that all other ships are welcome to travel through the Red Sea and that there is complete freedom of movement for any ship other than an Israeli or UK or US connected one. And I think that's extremely important. And the reason the Houthis have taken this action in support of Palestine is that one of the very fundamental policy issues or ideological positions that the Houthis have is the support for Palestine and more directly being anti-Israelis. The Houthis are, the Houthis' foreign policy is quite clearly summarized in their basic slogan of death to America and death to Israel. They are absolutely, you know, their positions are absolutely straightforward on these points. So although they are they are willing to allow other ships through, they are actually, up to a certain point, not displeased at the fact that the Americans and the U.S. are now actually targeting their various launch positions.
So, Helen, could you give us some background, though? What are the origins of this movement, and how is it that they came to play such a prominent role in Yemen?
Yeah, so the Houthi movement started in the 1980s, 1990s. I think what you need to understand is that in terms of religious sects, Yemen is divided into two basic sects. The Sunni sect of Shafi'is, who basically live in the majority of the country, and a branch of Shi'ism called the Zaydis, who live basically in the mountainous highlands of Yemen. And the Houthis are Zaydis. And in that sense, and again, within the Zaydi movement, there's a certain variety in the sense that the Houthis, I would say, are extremist Zaydis. And they've developed their ideology and their policies to strengthen their own branch of Zaydism. And they basically emerged in response to the rise of Sunni Salafi fundamentalism within their own area in the far north of Yemen. And so there have been conflicts and problems, you know, arising since the 1990s. Between 2004 and 2010, there was a series of six wars between the Houthis facing and fighting the then regime of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. And this ended basically, each one ended with a ceasefire, which was promptly broken. The reason the last one in 2010 was not broken as a result of the uprisings in 2011 of the, you know, known as the Arab Spring in various places. And that was a moment when the Houthis joined with the revolutionaries and basically took a position against where, you know, they continued their position against the regime. So they then were for during the what was a transition, supposedly a transition period between the Saleh regime and what should have become a more democratic regime in 2014. The Houthis then changed their alliances, and indeed Saleh changed his alliance. So they operated together against the transitional government. And then eventually that allowed them to take over the capital, Sana'a, in 2014, and then to oust the existing transitional government in early 2015. And that's when really the war started, which was then internationalized for March 2015 with the intervention of what was known as the Saudi-led coalition, which was basically a coalition led by the Saudis and the Emiratis with a few other states with minor roles, but supported actively by the US, the Europeans and the British and others.
And what was what was the point at which the Iranians started backing the Houthis? Was it in the moment when the Saudi-led bombing began in 2015, or was it prior to that? And if you could also clarify the distinction between, as you said, the Yemenis are Zaydi Shias, and to what extent Zaydis are ideologically or theologically aligned with the dominant form of Shiism in Iran, and what that has to do with Iran's complicity or support for Houthis, whether or not now they do as Iran says.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up these points. The Iranian role at the time in 2015, when we're in the internationalized civil war started, was minimal. The Iranian involvement with the Houthis and prior to that and since then has always been connected with partly theological connections, but differences. So in that sense, the Houthis are differentiating themselves from other Zaydis by having adopted a number of the rituals and activities and approaches of the Iranian Twelvers. It's all a matter of how many imams they trust or they believe in after the Prophet Muhammad. But in practice, the Houthis are getting closer to the Iranians to the Iranian Shiism over the last decades. But they are still quite distinct. So the alliance is much more a political alliance. And the Iranian involvement, which was really very, very insignificant at the beginning of this war, has increased over time and is primarily, has been for a while mainly financial and providing fuel and things like that to the Houthis, but more recently has been much more focused on military activities and primarily on the supply of advanced technology. If you look at the Houthi weaponry, and I'm no military expert, but the Houthi weaponry originally was basically a lot of Scuds and other Russian-supplied materials and also some American-supplied materials to the Saleh regime. And these have been upgraded and improved and changed to some extent thanks to Iranian support. So in that sense, you have more... The Iranian involvement has become greater. But it's very important to note that the Houthis are an independent movement. The Houthis are not Iranian proxies. They are not Iranian servants. They don't do what the Iranians tell them to do. They make their own decisions. If their decisions and their policies coincide with those of Iran, then, there's no issue. But if they don't, they don't do it. So it's very important, I think, to destroy this myth of, Iran-backed Houthis in a single word, as if it's kind of a conglomerate. That is not the case.
Helen,
I hope that briefly answered your point.
Yes, and we don't have much time, but I did want to ask you about the Houthi support in Yemen, whether it's increased, and the Houthi human rights record.
Yeah, great. Well, yeah, as you said, we haven't got much time. Basically, the support for the Houthis in Yemen has increased, has multiplied. I can't even imagine find a suitable terminology to say it. The Houthis, who run an extremely authoritarian and autocratic regime, which is not a pleasant regime for people to live under, and we're lacking support. And you have to remember that the Houthis actually rule and run the lives of 2/3 of the population of Yemen. So, about 20 million people live under Houthi rule. And it's not an unpleasant place to be. There's no freedom of expression. Women are oppressed. All kinds of negative features connected with Houthi rule. But the Yemeni population are extremely supportive of Palestine, and therefore this action of the Houthis has really, really increased their support. If you take a look, and you maybe show on your screen some of the demonstrations that happen every Friday, in Sana'a and in other cities, they've become absolutely massive, because all the people may not like living under Houthi rule, they agree with the Houthi actions in support of Palestine. And so that has increased and improved their popularity an enormous amount, not only in the area they rule, but also in the rest of Yemen, which is, not ruled by them.
Helen Lochner, we want to thank you so much for being with us, author of a number of books on Yemen, including Yemen in Crisis, The Road to War, and Yemen, Poverty and Conflict. She's been involved with Yemen for over 50 years, has lived there for about 15. Coming up, an investigative report by the BBC reveals new details of how American mercenaries were hired by the United Arab Emirates to run an assassination campaign in Yemen. Back in 60 seconds. I'm scared of dying. You set on fire. Am I a liar? Ooh. I'm scared of dying. No, I'm quiet. And America Likes Me by the 1975. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to another story out of Yemen. An investigative report by the BBC has revealed new details about how the United Arab Emirates hired American mercenaries to carry out more than 100 assassinations over a 3-year period beginning in 2015.